This is Fresh Air. Last week, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to establish an international tribunal to prosecute war crimes in the former Yugoslavia. The vote followed a UN report which cited evidence of mass killings, systematic rape, the destruction of towns, and the violent removal of whole groups of people. UN officials and human rights observers agree that the overwhelming majority of war crimes have been perpetrated by Serbs. My guest Christopher Simpson has written a new book about genocide and international law called The Splendid Blonde Beast. A lot of his research for this book and other projects focused on Nazi war crimes. Simpson teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. The Balkan War Crimes Tribunal will be the UN's first attempt to try war criminals. I asked Simpson what problems the tribunal is likely to face.
On one level, the problems are similar to any court, right? You have to gather evidence. You have to establish who has jurisdiction, which court has jurisdiction over these particular types of crimes. The court has to enjoy the respect and credibility that gives it the authority to make a judgment. Then there's, similar to other courts, there's the usual administrative type problems. Does the court have enough money to do its job? Does the court have enough personnel support and so on? And one thing that we saw during World War II, by the way, is that they set up war crimes prosecution teams largely as a propaganda gesture during the war. It was mainly for publicity purposes, but they kept them on a short leash by giving them no money or authority. I don't know whether that will happen in this case, but certainly it's something to watch out for. But behind all of that, there's a more fundamental problem. What that is that the structure of international law has been set up in such a way that it, in many circumstances, it tends to protect people who commit very serious crimes.
How does the law protect them?
Well, it's like this. To understand how, you have to go back to the turn of the century and sort of follow this thing forward. Basically what happened at the turn of the century is that there was a large, very expensive arms race among the major powers in Europe. And they came up with some proposals that were laws of war, that were an effort to, on the one hand, make war a little bit less barbaric, and on the other hand, to control the arms race of the day. The basic property of this law of war is that war would be conducted among regular uniformed armies, fighting on behalf of a organized government and with the government's authority. Good reasons for doing this. At the same time, this had the characteristic of making rebellions, guerrilla warfares, those types of popular resistance to oppressive governments, making them illegal. So the way this played out in both World War I and World War II is that you had the dominant powers, the more powerful countries, would occupy a particular country, you would have a local rebellion against this occupation, and the dominant country would say, aha, they're committing war crimes. Therefore, if we commit war crimes against them to stop them from committing them, therefore what we do is legal. Okay? It's called a reprisal. It's a legal doctrine known as reprisal. Now, to bring it up to the modern situation, what that means is that while politicians around the world can point to specific atrocities that are going on in the former Yugoslavia, some of which are clearly crimes in any common sense sort of way, actually prosecuting those crimes before an international tribunal may be considerably more complicated.
You know, I think a lot of us have been, watching what's happening in the former Yugoslavia from afar and wondering, what is the responsibility of our government to try to intervene or to try to bring war criminals to justice? I'd really like to know what you think about that.
The thrust of it is, the thrust of the way I look at it, is that the major powers of the world have set up an international system of law that largely benefits them. and they obey that law when it's advantageous for them to do so, and certainly make much noise about it in the media. For example, the prosecution of Manuel Noriega from Panama, the incursion into Grenada, and so forth and so on. But when the law is less to their liking, they ignore it. So what happens here is that international law is set up in such a way that those who have sufficient guns and money can obey it when they want to and ignore it when they want to. That type of approach to securing justice is never going to work over the long haul.
So if Noriega is an example of our country trying to obey international law, what's an example of our country ignoring it?
Well, for example, the mining of Nicaraguan harbors. This was clearly, as far as international law is concerned, it was an act of war. It was against the U.S. Constitution to do this. In any case, the Nicaraguan government, then led by the Sandinistas, took the United States to the International Court of Arbitration at The Hague, which was the appropriate forum, and the court held many hearings and so forth. The United States' response to this was not even to defend itself in these hearings, but simply what's called non-appearance. It refused to even play the game. The court eventually found in favor of the Nicaraguan government, condemned the United States for this particular action, and the Americans, the administration, continued a clandestine war against Nicaragua.
My guest is Christopher Simpson, author of the new book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Simpson. Your book, The Splendid Beast, is subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. What's the connection between money and genocide?
When radical, ideologically charged parties like the Nazis come to power, they've got an ideological agenda that they're pushing that includes genocide. But most people aren't going to buy that agenda, even if they vote for Adolf Hitler. So what do the Nazis or their equivalents do? Well, they introduce incentives into the society to participate in genocide. And so the first and most basic one was a program called Aryanization. And the Nazis were intent on driving people of Jewish heritage out of the German economy. So they essentially legalized Germans stealing from Jews. It could steal businesses. They could steal professional practices like law offices or doctor's offices. They would come in and take over the patients and so on. They could squeeze people with Jewish heritage out of the universities and so on. So you had many Germans saw this as an opportunity to advance themselves at the expense of other people, and they did.
So that's how genocide kind of becomes part of the structure of society. Not everybody is out there killing Jews in the case of Nazi Germany, but people are given a way to financially benefit from the destruction of the Jews and therefore are more likely to turn their heads when they find out what's happening.
Absolutely. And then afterwards, after the war, you have the circumstance where even people who maybe were not so enthusiastic about Hitler as such, they look back over their shoulder and they say, oh my God, I'm living in a house that I got for pennies on a dollar back in 1935 from the Jew that disappeared. Okay? And so that person maybe was not a big Nazi big shot, but that person is going to have a strong incentive to say, let's put this stuff behind us. We don't want to, call up all these old problems. Let's just move on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a big part of the explanation for Germany's response, or some sectors of Germany's response today, to the country's own history.
Now, you also say that there were certain incentives for American political and corporate leaders to help some of the former leaders of Nazi Germany escape without punishment.
Absolutely.
After the war, what were the incentives that Americans had to let them get away with it?
Several different ones. One was simple commerce, is that Germany is a large, very lucrative market. It's one of the most wealthy markets in the world. And some American corporate leaders saw that they could hold on to a big slice of the German market and the companies that that are active there by protecting particularly corporate leaders who had cooperated with the Nazis. So part of it was greed. Part of it was a political question, that they were afraid that that the system of private enterprise as we know it in the United States was under siege in Europe, and that unless they put these people back into power, that the system would fall apart.
But your point is that there are sometimes disincentives against punishing war criminals.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that this is that what happened in Europe in the wake of the war is an example of that. People can, because the war criminals come from the existing power centers in society.
The industrial elite, the political elite.
Right, exactly. The religious leaders and so on. The university professors, the intellectuals, the so-called notables, the magazine publishers, the radio broadcasters, for example. These people still have some measure of power and authority and respect in the wake of a genocide. And there will always be factions, I don't know if there'll always be, but there certainly are factions among the victors who see some sort of advantage in allying with them.
What you're saying now about Nazi Germany and how genocide was built into the system and how there were disincentives to prosecuting some of the Nazi leaders, could you apply that at all to the former Yugoslavia?
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, history doesn't repeat itself in some kind of neat little geometric pattern, but I think the European government's resistance to doing anything about the or doing much about the crisis in Yugoslavia is an illustration of this. They find themselves torn by their connections to the various factions in this conflict, so that they find themselves precluded from intervening to stop the fighting. Now, my personal opinion is, and this is not a particularly popular opinion, is that several European powers have a measure of responsibility for the civil war there, that this is not just something, an ethnic fight among Serbs and Croats. The German government backed the separation of Croatia from Yugoslavia. And it's clear that a large amount of the weapons in that conflict are coming from the former eastern satellite countries of the Soviet Union. You ask yourself, well, where do these people get all these guns, for heaven's sakes? Well, they're coming from the armies of the former East Bloc countries. You can imagine what the response would be if a country came to the United States or came to people in the United States and said to, like, for example, the Mexicans or the large Chicano population in the American Southwest, and say, okay, you all can have your own separate country now, and we'll recognize you diplomatically, and we'll give you guns to help pursue your aims. Well, what do you think the results would be? I think there would be an ethnic civil war in the southwestern United States, and I think that you would see some of these same sorts of atrocities take place. Frankly, I think that that's part of what's going on in Yugoslavia now.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christopher Simpson is the author of The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. This is Fresh Air.